Today on the Nerd Outcast podcast, the nerds of the many outweigh the nerds of the few, or the one. Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. As is common for this podcast, I've assembled a group of nerd experts to discuss Nicholas Meyer's 1982 film, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Let me go on and introduce those experts first. The first expert to my right is...
Kitten McCreary.
Hello, Kitten. Welcome back.
Hi. Happy to be back.
I'm glad that you're here. You were on the original series podcast.
I was indeed.
I think we'll probably reference that a few times.
Just the podcast or the series?
Probably both.
Oh, good.
I want to get viewership and listenership up for
there
both.
You go.
You know,
it'll be tasty.
Yeah, I feel Star Trek needs it.
It does.
My second expert is...
Patrick Sweetman.
Hello, Pat.
Hi, how are you, Chris?
I'm good. Thank you for coming out.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here on such a beautiful day in Chicago.
I know. No tornadoes or anything like that.
No, not in the city.
And you made it last minute, too, which really made me happy.
I took time out of my busy schedule just for you.
I know. You're really busy right now. You're actually legitimately busy.
Legitimately
so,
busy.
Yeah. But you love Wrath of Khan.
I do. That's why I made time for this.
Yeah. You were like, ooh, excellent.
Yes. I started watching it on Netflix before I came over here. Just make sure I'm sharp and...
It's been
like 4 weeks since I last watched it, so I needed to refresh.
Do you know how many times I've come over to your house
and
it just happens to be on? Yeah.
Quite often.
Yeah. My final expert for the evening is...
Dominic Ciangiolo.
Hello, Dominic.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
No problem. Welcome. You are a newcomer.
Yes.
That makes me very excited.
Yeah, glad to be here.
That means probably one more listener.
Yes, but hope. Well, maybe two. I got three people in the family besides myself, so.
Oh, good. Please, get them all in on this. And you're a Star Trek fan, right?
Yes, very much so.
Okay, and Wrath of Khan is pretty high up there for you?
Definitely.
Okay, all right.
Even Treks don't suck. That's the first rule.
Okay, all right. Well, all my experts, hold on to your thoughts and feelings about Wrath of Khan as I introduce my outcast for this episode. He's sitting across from me, and his name is...
Mark Sola.
So, Mark, I'm going to go on and just pin it on you right now.
Yep.
You confided in me that you did not think Wrath of Khan holds up, and you were not impressed with it.
Sure wasn't.
And I think I know so many nerds who would attempt to beat you up.
I like that you qualify it with attempt.
Yeah, they would attempt to.
Well, there are some nerds that know martial arts, you being one of them.
Yeah, I know.
So,
I don't know. I think I could take him.
I'm sure that all the nerds in this room could hurt me, either physically, mentally, or spiritually.
For those of you who recognize that voice, Mark was on the original series podcast that we did not too long ago, which is convenient. Because I'd like to have someone who was the outcast for that also on for this.
Yeah.
So I'll be curious if you have the same reasons for not liking Wrath of Khan that you don't particularly enjoy the original series. Having said all of that, I believe last time you were on, you said you do prefer science fiction over science fantasy. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes.
What's one of your favorite science fiction movies?
Movies?
Yes.
Oh, boy. Oh, jeez, now I'm really losing my nerd cred.
Bring it.
I love the Alien series. I guess that's sort of science fiction horror. Mm-hmm.
All of them, or do you...
No.
Okay,
the fourth one is really the best.
Let's see. I feel like I should know the answer to this one.
You should.
I should have a favorite sci-fi movie.
Yeah.
Strip him of his nerd badge.
No!
Do you have a favorite science fiction show?
Oh, yeah. Like, I love Battlestar Galactica, the remake.
Okay.
Oh, you got a problem with the original?
I don't think it is...
Wait, you're a Star Wars fan, right?
Yes, I do like Star Wars.
You're a big Star Wars fan.
I'm bigger of a Star Wars fan than Star Trek.
Okay.
But I think science fiction is more preferable to me than science fantasy. Like, I read The Forever War. which is really cool, like science fiction book. It's like a metaphor for Vietnam. I just finished 1984. So like sci-fi stories I really like more than sci-fantasy stories.
Okay.
And I'm definitely much more into like space battles than Middle Earth type fantasy medieval stuff.
Okay. And yet you don't like Wrath of Khan?
Is Wait, there a wizard in there that I'm missing?
Gentlemen, just calm down.
You said space battles. There's a great space battle in Wrath of Khan.
Sure, there is a great space battle between like two ships.
All right. I'm gonna hold them at bay.
That's not fair. That's not fair. Maybe some great things can be done between two consenting ships.
All right, Mark, have you seen Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan?
I have. It was a couple years ago, though.
Okay.
I'm a little rusty.
All right. Do you remember your thoughts or feelings from that viewing?
I have snippets that stick out with me.
Would you like to share them?
Snippets of feelings?
Snippets of feelings. That's all I'm capable of experiencing. Ricardo Montalban. He's the Khan, right?
Yes.
He's Mr. Khan. Khan.
Yes.
Him and his fine Corinthian leather.
Yes. I remember watching this and feeling like he had not aged that well and was still trying to play like this suave, sexy dude.
And that's the truth.
Yeah, like he's got his swash unbuckled, you know, and is like showing off his man pec. And I was like, dude, it doesn't work anymore. You got to put that away.
Oh.
And I that's just an...
I feel your pain.
That was his advanced genetic engineering.
And those were real, as Dick Meyer said many times.
Right?
He was in that kind of shape.
So that was, that's just an aesthetic problem I had with it. The horrible brain worms is so awesomely traumatizing. I thought it was neat. Like, I think I saw this movie as a youth, little snippets of it, but I definitely watched it in its entirety as an adult. I thought it was neat, but also, like, horrifying. And, like, Chekhov, of all the characters, he's so nice and, like, little and meek. And to have that happen to him is just, like, horrible.
Well, and I think that's one of the great things that made this such a good movie is this was what elevated it from the series. I mean, obviously the first movie, well, one of the best movies ever made.
Oh, wait, wait, wait.
I'm
all
totally
right.
Honest.
All right. All right. Let's, you know what, that's a great place. That's a great segue. Let's talk about Star Trek the Motion Picture. I have no information actually written down about the motion picture because I was going to talk about Wrath of Khan, but we do need to talk about motion picture because it definitely sets the stage. It came out in 1979, and it was definitely Paramount's reaction to Star Wars. It had David Weiss or Robert Weiss was the director?
Bob Weiss was the director.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who was apparently a very well-known director at the time. Gene Roddenberry had a lot of control over the script. Mm-hmm. I did read something really interesting. Or maybe I think it was one of the extra features on the movie. After a certain point in the script development, and I think this was across the board with all the Star Trek films, Leonard Nimoy and Bill Shatner got script control after like so many days. They could like cut or add whatever they wished to, which is really fascinating to me just as an actor, that you are like so well established that you can... And I mean, they have been playing those characters for a long time.
The entire franchise is based around those characters.
Yeah.
So yeah, the motion picture... Who likes... I'm going to say this. I like every Star Trek movie, no matter how bad it is. I do
really?
Like it.
You want me to put Search for Spock on?
Oh, I'll argue with you about Search for Spock.
No, Search for Spock is entertaining. Five was the only real disaster.
Final Frontier is pretty rough, but it's got moments. But motion picture... Does motion picture work? Who likes motion picture?
I liked motion picture.
I like the concept behind it. Mm-hmm. It just... I felt that some of it just didn't work. They were just... trying too hard in certain places.
It was just really belabored. I remember I saw it when it came out when I was 9. Like, first weekend, my parents took us to go see it. And it was just blown away by this massive experience in the theater. Yeah. But now you go back to it, and it's just like you're watching it on 10 speed
more,
on the PlayStation.
More blown away than Star Wars?
In some ways, yeah. Star Wars definitely stuck in a way that the motion picture didn't, but... Still, it was just really something. Because I'd seen the original series, my aunt was a huge fan, and just to see that transition from television to the big screen was something. And of course, that's when all the special effects and stuff were really new.
Well,
you know, even Wrath of Khan was groundbreaking.
That's a point I wanted to mention. I think I heard that this was the first time that a TV series had been promoted into, like, a feature film. Does anybody know if there was another TV series that went from show to film?
MASH?
Went the other way around.
Yeah,
MASH
started as a film.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, well, as a...
I can't think of one.
But
which actually may have been part of the problem for that first film, is they didn't know how to do that.
Back at the
as
time,
well.
They did weird stuff, because, like, and this was a little bit after Wrath of Khan, but, like, Buck Rogers, they pieced together a 2-hour movie from the TV show and they released it in theaters. Hmm. They did the same with Battlestar at one point. I remember this as a kid, like, what the hell is this? And it's the same thing you'd seen on TV. But
and the Battlestar movie was horrible. They chose, like, the worst things to put together for that.
Yeah.
But those weren't produced on, like, a motion picture budget.
No, those were just clip shows.
Okay. Yeah. This may have been the first time.
Yeah, and, like, the motion picture, I think one of the problems behind that was, you know, there was definitely a heavy leaning towards the special effects, and that the story, though interesting with an interesting turn, is kind of weak in many places. Where I thought that when we get to Wrath of Khan, story was a much bigger element to this one, which is why it still holds up. Yes, the effects are all very dated at this point, but the story still holds up.
I will admit, I recently watched the motion picture, and Kirk is a dick.
Yeah,
we talked about this in the podcast, that in the original series, Kirk would be a dick.
Mm-hmm.
He'd just be an asshole for no reason.
Because he could be.
And in the motion picture, like, he comes on board, he takes control from Deckard, he's happy about it, he doesn't care that he's not as familiar with the Enterprise, which obviously puts the mission in danger at certain points. Yeah. Like, he's kind of a jackass. Like, he's the hero, but you're like, do I really want to side with that guy?
Yeah. Well, and this leads us into an interesting transition as we're getting into the second movie, Wrath of Khan, and I was watching one of these, you know, kind of behind the stories things, and they were talking about the screenwriters had this great idea. Basically, you know, Kirk and the Enterprise get attacked, Kirk loses people and stuff. Bill Shatner didn't want to do it. He was like, Kirk can't be weak, he can't lose and stuff. The directors and the screenwriters had to talk him into this, like, adding elements and depth to the character of Kirk. And thank God he finally talked him into it. He agreed, because that's really what, you know, adds weight to this entire story in the movie.
I mean, and it's kind of in a lot of ways, it's the premise of the movie.
And from there on, I think that, you know, seeing the success of that, that's where you see every other movie, you know, you see he becomes more human. He's not as much of a dick as he was in the TV show or the first movie.
Yeah, I saw some interviews with William Shatner, and he was very hesitant to play Kirk older. And William Shatner was in his 50s, I believe.
He was in his T.J. Hooker phase.
He was in his but he was in his 50s when they were about to do Wrath of Khan. And he was really, really hesitant to play an older Kirk, which I actually really like that.
Yeah, it gives it a lot of texture that you wouldn't have otherwise.
All right, well, let's talk about the film. We're kind of jumping around. It was released in 1982, directed by Nicholas Meyer, story by Harve Bennett and Nicholas Meyer. You've seen the movie, Mark, so I'm not going to tell you the plot.
Right, who needs to know the plot?
Well, anybody in listening land want a quick synopsis?
I think anyone listening to this particular podcast
knows
the
surely. Stop listening, go watch Wrath of Khan.
Then come back and listen to the rest of this.
Or read Moby Dick, and then.
That's
the same story.
Oh.
With less Genesis.
Oh, did you not?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Oh, he quotes Moby Dick throughout the movie.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
All right.
That's all right.
All right. What do you guys want to talk about first? I've got a whole bunch of different talking points.
Kobayashi Maru.
There you go.
Well, here we go.
Kobayashi Maru and that, and then the reboot.
Since we've already brought up age, a couple of the themes that Wrath of Khan deals with: life and death, aging, friendship, the no-win scenario, of course.
Mm-hmm.
These are all major themes.
The needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few.
Oh, yes.
Yep.
Or the one. These are all major themes throughout the film. These seem like a ridiculous amount of themes, and I'm like thinking of the first film, and what was the theme of the first film? Like, we just sail along.
Science coming back to kill you.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's kind of
it. Well, I think the reason there's so many themes...
If you
see Nick Meyer's memoir on this, when he got involved in the project, 5 different people had taken a pass at the script.
Yeah.
And he had 12 days to try to take all those ideas and turn it into one thing. Yeah. So I think that's why it is thematically all over the place, is because he was picking and choosing all these different things to try to then bring it together and make one story out of it.
But
he also,
for me, it works, though. I mean, because it's layer
great.
Upon layer. It's, you get so many different things. Because a lot of the other Star Trek, especially the episodes, were, you know, very one-dimensional, single theme all the way through. And where this is, you know, you got several different things going on.
And it all sort of works because it's you don't even have the focus on all of the themes through all of the movie. It's almost like segmented of like, now we're going to talk about this thing, and now we're going to talk about this, and then this, and then by the end we'll come back to tying 1, 2, and 3 together.
Yeah.
And
Did any of you see this in the theater?
Yes.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. I did not.
Because I'm
this
old.
Weren't born yet.
This may be your oldest podcast ever.
You didn't see it in the theater.
I was born the year it came out.
Ah, you little zygote. Dominic, I'll start with you. What was it like seeing this in the theater?
I mean, I think it was great. I mean, you know, even at the time, the effects, though now dated, were incredibly cutting edge. You know, it was a really gripping story. I think my interest in the original series Trek had blossomed between the motion picture and The Wrath of Khan. I knew the characters a lot better. And then I just really identified with the relationship between Kirk and Spock. Of course, the age elements I understood, but I appreciate them much more now than I did back then, obviously, as a 12-year-old. But then I think always stuck me the most was the conversation between Spock and Kirk, where Spock is talking about you know, him taking over the Enterprise and how it was a mistake to leave command, that being captain was his first best destiny and everything else is a waste of material. And that's like, that has become like my mantra in pursuing what I've pursued over these years, is like, and that's what's kept me single-mindedly focused on what I do professionally.
You're
and
a starship captain?
It's exactly.
Amazing. Awesome.
But just that attitude, you know, just like looking at life that way. And that just, it hit me then. I was an impressionable 12-year-old and it just stuck.
I feel that scene is almost an apology for like the way Kirk acted in the motion picture, where he's like, no, I don't want to take command. No. Remember Deckard? He got really pissed off. Just, you do the ship.
Just Spock, just tell me to go to hell. I'll fuck
it's
off.
Okay. Yeah. It's okay.
Pat, you saw this in theater.
Yes.
What'd you think?
I loved it. I mean, I was, you know, a young kid, seven, I guess. So I loved it. It was just, blew me away. That's what I watched. And at that point, I mean, being only seven, I don't think I'd seen much of the original series, if any, at that point. I don't think I'd seen the original movie. But this, from that point on, I saw all the other Star Trek movies. And I was already a huge Star Wars fan at that point, you know.
Were your parents Star Trek fans? Like,
I think my dad might have been a little bit. It was, you know, this was my, you know, obvious parents that took me. I wasn't allowed out of the house by myself at seven. So.
Yeah. I'm gonna go to the movie. All right, cool. Kitten.
Yeah, totally saw it in the theaters. Mentioned when we were talking about original series, I was raised by geeks. So yeah, they were Star Trek fans.
They like gypsies.
Yes. Yes. But yeah, I mean, they were like, you know, Star Trek fan club, lots of conventions and things like that. So of course, when the movie came out, it was like the midnight showing for the, you know, night before, when we're like loading up in the car to drive an hour and a half from our podunk nowhere small town in South Georgia to Albany, where the mall was, so we could go to the movies. So yeah, it was fantastic. And it was beautiful. It was such a beautiful thing to see, and not just for the special effects and things like that, but it took, I felt, so many of that nice, weird Technicolor aspect of the original series and brought that to the screen so much more than the first movie did. Because I think with the first movie, they're like, no, we really want to be a movie. We're going to be cinema. We're going to streamline this and this and, you know, make it a lot more dry and realistic and whatever else. And for Wrath of Khan, they're like, no, we're going to have this one room that's just all kind of white and blue. It's going to be great. And I mean, and that was, I appreciated that. I appreciated that aesthetic tie-in. And again, I just thought it was a beautiful narrative.
Mark, do you have any comments so far?
Okay, obviously I didn't see it in the theater. My father was into Star Trek, more so Next Generation and DS9 than Classic Trek, I guess. Uh-huh. And I think we had Wrath of Khan in the house, like we had some VHSs of the movies. Mm-hmm. So I saw snippets as a kid, but don't ever recall sitting down and watching the entire thing. Mm-hmm. Upon adult watching it, I was struck. Because isn't Kirstie Alley?
Yes.
She seemed very out of place. Like, hey, it's the 80s. Here's a Pepsi Cola and some sneakers. And you remember Kirstie Alley.
Well, this was nobody before Cheers.
Yeah,
oh,
this is her first role.
Yeah,
this was very early in her career.
She seemed very out of place, like, in terms of interacting with the other...
But
that was the point of it, because, you know, you had this tight knit, you know, the entire bridge crew. She was the character that, you know, the sounding board to, you know, why is everything exactly
plot,
why is
right.
everything happening, and, you know,
the fish out of water.
She was a plot device in many ways, and sometimes that was the problem with having a second Vulcan there. I mean, obviously Spock is the template for it, but everyone else is supposed to be so, you know, straightforward.
But see, in my mind, Kirstie Alley has played the best Vulcan until Zachary Quinto in the new one.
Oh yeah,
because I'm not a fan of.
What about T'Pol?
DePaul was worthless. Enterprise was worthless.
I found some value.
I three episodes and that was it.
Wait, what about Spock? What about, like, Leonard Nimoy?
Well, Leonard Nimoy is obviously... Okay. It probably goes, like, Leonard Nimoy, Mark Leonard as his father, and then Kirstie Alley. That would be my top three.
Is Tuvok
is probably under her somewhere.
I might put Savick.
And Robin Curtis is...
What about Odo's a pretty good
Was that who did Savick?
Yeah, exactly. And that's no knock against Robin Curtis. I'm sure she's a nice person, but she's... At that point, it just didn't work. So.
Yeah, the movie was... I got problems with episode 3.
You know, I'm really thankful that Shatner... I'm just going to call him Shatner, because that's...
That's all right. He prefers that.
Cool. Priceline guy.
Yeah. I'm glad that he didn't have, like, a romance with Savick. Like, because I felt like that was coming.
Right.
New girl, she's, like, pretty and young, and I was like, oh, God, she's going to be the one who
rescues. There's even a joke about that in the motion picture when... What is the name of the bald chick that shows up?
Ilea
shows up, and like Kirk is like, "Hi," and she's like, "My record of celibacy is on record, Captain, or whatever." And he's like, "Oh yeah, I can't hit on you."
with Khan, they went the opposite direction because you had Carol Marcus, who was his ex.
Yeah,
right. Hold on to that. I want to talk about that specifically.
But that obviously goes the opposite direction from Kirk just nailing everything in the galaxy.
Right.
He's now dealing with old feelings, old relationships.
Repercussions.
Yes.
So let's talk about the characters, because we're kind of doing that anyway.
Yeah.
Sure.
Let's start with William Shatner. I love this Kirk. Mm. I love this Kirk so much more than the original series Kirk.
It's my favorite
And Kirk. I'm not saying that original series Kirk is bad.
I like this guy better than Kirk Cameron.
Yeah, there you go. I just like that there's something, and as a kid I didn't pick up on this, but I pick up on it now. Like, I love that he's older and he's so unhappy and he doesn't entirely know why. Or maybe he doesn't know why. He doesn't want to face it.
Because he's effectively been put out to pasture.
Yeah.
That's why he's so excited and, you know, Bones offers him a sedative when they're taking the Enterprise out. he can't wait to get back out in space, but he, you know, feels like he's stuck being the Admiral back at Starfleet.
And, I mean, there's that scene with Bones at the beginning where he's like, you know, like, you got to get it together.
Yeah,
you don't want to end up with
one. Get your command back. Get back out there,
What I think is wonderful is Nick Meyer's directing, and you just unfortunately don't see these days because it's too slow for people. Like, that scene takes place in one two-shot.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the two of them talking, and you get to see the whole performance, and just the whole beat just plays out with them, and it's beautiful. It's supposed to, you know, you could have punched in for close-up, done a whole bunch of different things, and it just plays, and it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Dominic's the director, by the way. So, no, that's a really great point. Yeah, I think Nick Meyer is a really great director. Well, let's focus on Shatner.
So
what else? What else do you guys want to say about William Shatner? I really think this is one of his best performances.
Yeah, in general. I mean, across every, you know, things on TV and movie.
And this is the start of a small trilogy within the greater six Star Trek films, essentially. Plot lines that start in 2, continue through 3 and 4.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk, through the next 2 movies, mm-hmm. He's a broken man, essentially.
Yeah.
Like, he is tormented.
But you see the destruction and the rebuilding of him.
Which I think is
great. Yeah, which is, makes the trilogy. Hmm. I mean, and even 4, I'm not crazy about the whales, but it's a good story.
Yeah.
And it's,
I just love the humor in that one.
The humor's great.
They really needed it.
It's definitely a capsule of the 80s, the Save the Whales thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else about Kirk?
Well, for Kirk in that one, I thought, and again, it was such a nice change from the Kirk from the series, where he is all cowboy swagger.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Now it's like, okay, your cowboy is old. You know?
Yeah.
It's just, he's done. And I think it was also one of those things that really served the story for that, because even when Khan was introduced in the series, you know, they were supposed to be, Kirk and Khan were supposed to be very much the same archetype.
Yeah.
They were
right.
supposed to be the guys who were intelligent and charismatic and wooing the ladies and all of that. And, you know, so you finally start to see a villain who's likable. And so all of the things you have with, you know, with Kirk, that's his swagger and his strength and his confidence, he's absolutely stripped of it. And having to go in and tell this story and be like, okay, now not only am I going up in character against my nemesis, in storyline, I'm going up against, you know, this archetype that was created to be basically the same, and whereas I have become old and sad and pudgy and defeated, Khan is, in a lot more ways, so much more virile and so much more manly because he's also faced loss. He's also faced destruction. But instead of just letting it be like, oh no, I'm just going to tuck my tail between my legs and whine about it, he's like, now I'm going to find a way to kill you all.
Yeah.
Well, mine. It's, yes. And it's beautiful.
Yeah. And this gets into those themes we discussed earlier, the life and death. And it's like, obviously Khan has... He's single-mindedly focused on revenge now. This is where,
yes.
you know, the strong, you know, Moby Dick, you know, parallel throughout the entire movie. I mean, he is, you know, Ahab.
Which makes
Kirk
it so much funnier that
whale.
Kirk is the white whale. Because that was all pudgy
yeah.
and sad.
Yeah.
He wasn't quite that pudgy back then, though.
In many ways, but
he
now. Kirk has that fire, and there's several times where, you know, he always yells his name, Khan's
yeah.
name so loud that you can hear it throughout space.
Yeah.
He wants to kill Khan. But at the same time, he said people die in his arms. This Kirk is starting to soften. He's starting to realize life is valuable a little bit.
I feel this movie does a great job of... I feel this is one of the few instances where the Enterprise crew could be wiped out. There's not a lot of instances where the whole crew is in jeopardy.
That's what's
and
great
that's
about
the
this is a movie, and you see it so many times with movies, that, especially that come from TV series these days. You have to do something to elevate, to heighten it. Where in a TV series, and even in the episode of the first movie, they never heightened to that kind of danger level. Where this movie certainly did, where it was. Major characters could die.
Right.
I mean, they did. It was just a function of the writing. I mean, with the V, I mean, the V'ger probe one. I mean, that was going to potentially wipe out the planet. It's
yeah.
similar.
Yeah.
It's very similar to 4. And certainly in the TV series, they had any number of threats that were
but
you know, galaxy level. But it just doesn't resonate.
We
talk about Kirk in this
yeah.
one.
I mean, you never lost, like, through the entire series and through and in the first movie, you never lost characters that you were invested in.
Oh,
it
right.
was always throwaway characters.
Right.
And then this was the first time you even had the opportunity to lose characters that you
yeah.
cared about.
Yeah, exactly.
And
no, certainly.
And that was a nice thing to see. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's, you know, what heightened, you know, the risk for the series overall.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But you talk about, you know, Shatner and this Kirk, I mean, you know, I would agree there, this is probably the best Kirk. And you know, it's funny, Shatner has a reputation for just being a real ham bone.
Yeah.
I think he plays into that reputation. But I think it's also largely a function of the material. I mean,
mm-hmm.
all Kirk of the series required was that swagger, the occasional
yeah.
moment of pathos,
yeah.
and some self-awareness. And here he really got put through the emotional ringer. And you know, it's the credit to everybody. They convince him to actually do this.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know. I think it shows what he actually is capable of if he's shepherded properly.
Yeah.
All
right. So yeah. Khan.
Khan.
Ricardo Montalban. A man who is passionate about his wife. So when this movie came, out and you saw The Wrath of Khan, did you guys go, who's Khan? Like, did you remember who Khan was? Had you all
yeah.
seen that?
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
I'd seen Spacey before.
So
yeah.
here's my question. Was this the appropriate villain, or was there something else you would rather have seen from the original series? Or do you feel...
No, I think...
Dribble.
Because I've seen the Space Seed episode. It is a good episode, but there's nothing about it that like pointed that Khan was going to be like a major villain.
Well, but I thought that was, you know, because the way they ended it, was, you know, Khan was still alive and out there
mm-hmm.
in the galaxy. Which,
mm-hmm.
so this was a great
yeah.
way for them to do a movie tie-in with the original series.
In the original series, they rarely had villains.
Yeah.
It was much more like
motion
picture where
it was the
situation that was the threat as opposed
mm-hmm.
to one person.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So,
and I mean, and in this really, like, Khan... In Space Seed, Khan wasn't even really a villain. And I think that was one of those wonderful things about that episode that you then, you know, later get to see in Wrath of Khan. Because, you know, in any truly good story, the villain is never the villain in their own story. They're doing what they think is right and what they think is just. And so in Space Seed, like, you know, his people had... been used and manipulated, and you know, and then finally they're like, when the government's like, nope, we screwed up by making you, so we're, you know, basically gonna, you know, freeze you and hope this never comes back to bite us in the ass. Lo and behold, it did. And all he was trying
happened.
To do was save his people.
I thought
well,
the eugenics
you know, they
war was that Khan and like 12 other super whatever you wish to call them Captain America's took over various parts of the world with their armies.
Yeah.
And
well, they were
world,
nasty people.
I mean,
then
but
the
they,
world fought
but
back.
But they were designed...
They,
I mean, they were built to do that. They're like, hey, we need to make these super soldiers. And the super soldiers are like, great. We're going to go out and fight. And we're going to... But his own people even talked about the fact that... he was benevolent and he was kind and he took good care of them. You know, but like the government built them to be like, hey, we're going to build these super soldiers so that you can take these lands for us. And they did. And then all of a sudden it's like, nope, can't have them anymore.
I remember them being very ruthless when they're running through his dossier. These were not, I mean, yes, you're right. Every villain, he's the hero of his own story, clearly.
But he was ruthless in the ways that it was his job.
But I think he exceeded the parameters of his job, which was the problem, which is why he was launched into space.
Yeah, I thought he had this philosophical thing. No, I'm the outcast, so I don't remember much. But when I saw the Space Seed episode, which I went back and watched after I watched Wrath of Khan, I was like, who is this guy? What's he all about? I thought there was this whole thing where he's like, we are superior to you. Of course, we deserve this planet. And I was like, oh, this is a Hitler metaphor.
But,
okay.
Well,
yeah, he was pretty clearly a Hitler analog.
Sort of, but I still feel like, again, it was one of those things. They were designed. The government's like, yes, you're superior to us because we built you this way.
Well, right, but there was like that sort of thing where it's not just we're humans with special powers. It's like we're better than you now, so we rule.
But they were.
you are a eugenic sympathizer.
I am.
For the purpose of.
But for the purpose of the movie, Robert yes, Cotton. I think he was a fantastic villain for this because it was one of your moments that like. Through weird twist of fate in their fight, Kirk manages to like grab a wrench and hit him and be like, "No, we're gonna put you out." So he's like, "So we're gonna send you out to this planet and you can rebuild and do whatever,
and then never check up on you."
Right?
For 15
it's like we're never
years.
Gonna do this. And
Kirk had another space date. He bounced around the galaxy. Green women left
everywhere.
Right. I mean, and I feel like there's a lot of Wrath of Khan that's structured on the whole. Consequences of Kirk's actions.
The consequences.
Yeah. That's why you're the outcast.
Outcast lives in pun zone.
Was there anything else from the original series? Like, do you wish the Klingons had been pushed further? Or, I mean, obviously they do in later movies, but at the time, when Wrath of Khan came out,
they were responsible for blowing up the Enterprise during the Kobe Hashimaru.
Oh,
there you go.
Got my Klingon.
Which just shows how racist the Federation is.
well, that was the big bad at the time.
It was the big bad.
I mean, the Romulans were a threat, but it was always the Federation versus the Klingons all through the original series.
Is Khan more intelligent than Kirk?
Yes.
Yes.
Is he a better tactician?
No.
Had he been given enough time?
I think, yes.
More experience
in the field.
Yeah,
he would have beaten him.
He wasn't,
which is what they point out, his lack of experience,
Now, just refresh my memory. Let's cut to the space fight that they do.
Yes.
Right.
There's always like a...
Which one, the first encounter or the one in the nebula?
The one that kills Khan.
The one in the nebula.
Yeah, the
nebula.
Yeah.
There's always like a, oh, they think we're on this frequency, now we're on this frequency, fire, fire! And then they fire and then the bad guy explodes. How did they outsmart Khan in this one?
They lured him into the nebula first so that the sensors wouldn't... They basically
like hiding
evil,
in a cloud.
Both ships were damaged, so they lured him in so they could have a chance.
Right. And also their protective shields, which the Enterprise no longer had, it was so damaged,
would
not operate in the nebula. So not only were they running blind,
the Reliant would be
but they were vulnerable because they damaged shields.
Yeah, okay. I mean, and the Reliant, if I remember correctly, the Reliant was already a superior ship.
No, it was a little scout ship.
It had taken the
Enterprise
by surprise.
Yeah.
Right.
So the Reliant was a Federation ship that Khan had got.
Yes, he
stole it.
He kidnapped Chekhov and Paul Winfield.
That's right.
Yes.
He did Grand Theft Auto.
He put bugs in their ears and took off their ship.
So the first thing that they did is like Kirk basically like hacks into the system and lowers
the
Reliant shield,
shuts
down the
bridge.
Which
is brilliant. Yes.
And then lures him into the nebula to put them more on an equal footing because when their technology was at an equal footing. Kirk had the advantage because he had the years of experience
that Khan had never really...
And so once they got into the battle in the nebula, they beat him because he wasn't thinking in the Z-axis. He's fighting on the surface and they're up and down.
Right.
And
that's right.
Plays
don't
very
they, like,
quickly.
Come in from above or something?
Yeah, they come up underneath him,
He forgot that things can be up and down too.
Yes.
If only he was a submarine captain.
Well,
it felt very submariney to me.
This is because of Kirk's years of 3D chess playing.
Yes. Of course.
But of course it was Spock that pointed out this flaw in his thinking. So
Spock is the greatest captain.
You know, I like chess in Star Wars better, where it's 3D, but because there's little hologram guys that eat each other.
That's awesome. Yes.
That's space chess.
Cat chess.
So we all really like Ricardo Montalban. I think he's a fine actor. Yeah, he's great.
Yes.
He's great.
Yes.
He's great. That's all I can say about that.
And a podcast.
And a podcast. Part of a podcast.
Think on that.
Just a whole podcast just on Ricardo Montalban.
Yeah, you could.
We could, really.
Especially the way you say his name, Ricardo Montalban.
I got an episode of Columbo where he was the bad guy.
Ooh, there you go.
So as we're delving through characters, was it weird to give Kirk a son, or did that make complete sense that this cowboy who had to have bet so many women would sooner or later have a son?
I feel like it
I mean,
I feel
this
like
doesn't
it made
bother
sense.
Me.
I feel like it made sense and it didn't. I mean, because he's out like stooping everything in the galaxies, that's going to catch up. But I sort of feel like him being Markham's son, like that, I feel like that was a little contrived.
Yeah, in this movie especially, I felt that that was one of those plot devices or storylines that it was only so-so. It was kind of like, it just kind of got in the way, and David was just mostly bitching about the military the whole movie.
Yeah.
In obviously in episode 3, or the third movie rather, it comes to fruition, but in this movie it just felt underdone.
Right,
you know,
because there was no real consequence of it. It's like they made it a really big deal that this was Kirk's son.
It became a thing at the end.
Right.
But you needed it in the middle. When he finally meets Carol and he's got his son.
Yeah, this is David.
And the big fight over, you know, the fact he didn't know about it. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was a really great scene.
Well, and there were some interesting things, because that helped bring out, you know, how he passed the Kobayashi Maru. So brought out some stories and some depth into Kirk. So.
I mean, I feel like I kind of can see all of your points to this. I don't feel the character is as useless. I feel they like they were setting something up. Like they introduced David, and I think they knew if they were going to make a Star Trek 3, David would be in it in some fashion.
Yeah, that's very possible. His character.
But there wasn't supposed to be a Star Trek 3.
What?
Well, there wasn't until maybe 10 days before the shoot was over.
That was the only reason Leonard Nimoy agreed to do it.
Really?
He wasn't going to do it. And then he's like, oh, but this is going to be the last movie? Fine. Send me out in a blaze of glory.
Wow.
And then he's like, well.
And then as they were filming, they began to realize
they're
making
movie?
A really
good
movie.
Okay, let's do that.
I was rewatching the interview with him yesterday, and he's like, I signed up thinking that this was going to be it. We weren't going to do it anymore. And then it became clear over the course of production that there was going to be another one.
Yeah.
There should be another one. So that's when Harv Bennett and him came up with the whole remember bit in the thing. And that Shatner was funny in the same interview, because he was talking about how nobody else knew that's what was going on. It was just like, I just thought this was a little piece of business and nobody knew. So they're playing the whole death scene like it's really the end, which was great from a directorial standpoint, because you're really feeling it. And then it's like you felt totally jobbed because it's in fact the way to get us to the next movie.
Right.
And I heard a story, and I don't know how much truth there was, that one of the deal basically to get Nimoy involved was to let him direct the third movie.
He negotiated that, when they were done with the second movie, they greenlit the third movie really quickly. They knew they were going to bring Spock back. And Leonard Nimoy, I think he talked with his agent and was like, I want to direct it. So met with like Michael Eisner and all of them and got on board with it. Yeah. He directed 4 also, didn't he? He directed 3 and 4, didn't he?
He might have.
Yes.
No. Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Smiter came back for 6.
Yeah. And Shatner directed 5. anyway, back to Wrath of Khan.
Back to a good one.
Back to Wrath of Khan. Anything else you guys want to say about David or Carol? Yeah. Marcus.
I just wanted to slap both of them.
Really?
Because they're not superior humans like you?
Exactly!
Uh-huh.
No, they were so...
They're scientists, not the militant type that she likes.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
There was something about Kirk hooking up with the really cool, like, the scientist. And then she invents this really amazing, really, really, really amazing technology, which we'll talk about the Genesis device.
But he hooked up with other intelligent, creative, and dynamic women.
But they were green.
Are you saying that something within Kirk's masculine prowess is delivering scientific breakthroughs to the female community?
Yes. Yes. That's exactly what he's saying.
His seed is a magical...
What do you think they mean by space seed?
Of course.
Yes.
Kirk can't use it himself. He needs to give it to someone else.
No, I mean, they were just so whiny. They were both just so whiny, through everything, but then everybody gets killed. All the scientists at the station, right? Everybody's dead and strung up, and they're just like, meh.
It's space. It's different rules apply.
I was like, wait a minute.
I mean, their grief wasn't necessarily core to the plot, so I could see why you would have skipped over that.
Yeah. He may not have told them either, like, oh, by the way, Khan...
Yeah, we saved everybody upstairs.
No, I mean, they came out, like, when they were in the little storage closet hiding, they came out, they're like, he killed them all. They knew everybody was dead, but then it's like...
No, they'd left. They'd left before that happened. Yeah, they did not necessarily have that piece of information.
Paul Winfield.
David's...
I could see that, but Carol was whining.
Her whiny was, you know, calling Kirk and say, "Don't, why are you letting him take it and stuff?" And that's because, you know, the entire project was in jeopardy.
Right. I mean, but after that, she was being, like, you know, shanghaied by the military is what she thought. And, like, and...
But even then, she wasn't so whiny. David was definitely... I mean, he could give Luke Skywalker a run for his
money. They're both blind.
That's right.
Hey, at least Luke becomes a Jedi. So, Spock. And the death of Spock. Spock dies.
What?
What?
Wait.
Oh,
spoilers! I always start the movie 15 minutes early.
So
my VHS copy.
A couple of
Snape kills him.
Snape kills him.
But he had to.
But he comes back as Gandalf the White. It's okay.
Spock the White. Yeah.
So for Spock dying,
greatest movie moment. Well, not ever, but one of those greatest.
It was really great, especially like being separated by the glass. That is such an iconic.
Yeah,
it's parodied
shot to me
all the time in comedy shows.
Mm-hmm.
They always have that glass moment. Yeah,
sure,
but not always. But
I grew up with these movies, so I knew like there was no surprise about Spock dying. Like I just knew he died, just like I knew Vader was Luke's father. Spoiler alert.
Well, and that's what I mean, when I was a kid and saw this in the first time in the theater, that was one of those big things that stuck with me. Because
as far as you knew, that was it.
Main characters don't die, and all of a sudden...
Yeah, they whack Spock.
Yeah, Spock's gone.
So I have a couple questions specifically about the death of Spock. So the original ending for Star Trek II was Spock's funeral. Like, they do the funeral, and then that's it. Like, there is no shooting him out or, like, focusing on the Genesis planet or having Kirk look at the Genesis planet. Like, it's the funeral and then the end. And
Kirk winks at the Genesis planet.
I'll be back here. And they tested that with audiences, and the audience, it was like going to a funeral.
Yeah.
And it was really depressing.
No,
so they changed the ending.
I can see where that would definitely be an even more major bummer than it was.
Yeah. So do you all feel... Are you glad Spock came back, or do you think they should have left him dead and like continued on without him for the rest of the films, or should this have been the final film?
Well, if this had been the final film, we wouldn't have gotten episode 6 or movie 6. Which
we also may not have gotten Next Generation.
Generations.
Yeah.
Badass film.
Mark, just play it cool, man.
All right.
I think he's such a core to Trek. It's like, I think if you kill him, you have to end the story because it is the yin yang of Kirk and Spock
that works.
So without him, Kirk would be rudderless.
Yeah.
You know, he wouldn't be the same person.
You could have Savick.
Would not have fit the role.
New Spock.
She wouldn't have fit the role that well.
No. Pepsi. Crystal Pepsi.
I am glad they brought Spock back. I thought that was valuable. I do feel like, you know, doing the shot of the casket on Seti Alpha.
We probably could have done without.
Yeah, I mean,
but
the
launching
like
him
was,
into the Genesis, the worshiping life while celebrating. You know,
right. I mean, but I feel like it could have. I feel like all of that still could have been conveyed by. Have the funeral, launch him.
Yeah, exactly.
Have the same voiceover, but
don't
give us
show
that
the picture
shot.
Of the,
I mean,
it's for the dummies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I guess that's why I don't like it because.
Right.
Well, I think you had to give
it's
that hope. If you had just shot him out of the spacecraft and gone right there, you would not have that hopeful moment they needed at the end. And yeah, it's on the nose, definitely.
But that's the thing. Like, I guess I don't mind sad endings. I don't think you needed that hopeful
moment.
Well,
but the problem is, Harv Bend, they did these tests, and they knew the movie was going to take. And, you know, there's a certain point where you have to recognize your audience's expectations and deal with them. If you ignore them at your peril.
I mean, and again, I recognize, like, the audience testing and how people are like, everybody wants something to have a happy ending.
But it's not it's an ambiguous ending. Because even with that... All that was saying it was the connection of life and death and how things go on. You were not necessarily, you left it vague. Well, people could interpret that this was an opening for the third film, but at that point there had been no announcements. I certainly walked out of the theater as a 12-year-old thinking that he was gone.
Yeah.
So
what was your reaction to the Remember?
I did not pick up on it. When I first saw it on VHS after the movie, I thought they had added it.
Yeah,
in the home release.
The same way. It wasn't until episode or the third movie. I keep calling them episodes, but
yes,
you want them to be Star Wars.
Yeah, I do. It's so deep down, I kind of do.
Mark, stop.
You want this, don't you?
No, but I was the same way. It wasn't until Search for Spock that it was like, yeah, I was the same way. I thought they edited that in. You know, I had to go back and watch Wrath of Khan, which in the 80s was hard because VHS tapes were not easy to get.
Yeah.
Can I drill down into this casket for a moment?
Yes, right. My outcast. My nerds are fighting.
The outcasket. So you launch Spock's body in a space casket.
Yes.
Right?
Photon torpedo tube.
Yes.
Is it in a photon torpedo casing?
Yes, it is.
It's in one of
the... It's in the casing of the photon torpedo.
They took the warhead out and put Spock in.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Theoretically, the warhead may still be in there.
Yeah. So they shoot it and it goes down to the Genesis planet.
It's soft
right?
Lands.
They explain it in the third movie.
Yeah. Okay, so is
or
there
episode three?
Is there an atmosphere?
Yes.
Why doesn't it burn up on re-entry?
Well, that's what they're saying. The unstable atmospheric elements created a soft landing for it.
What?
It was a plot device for Spock to live.
But they addressed that.
They addressed it in the third movie.
Wait. Yeah. You have a problem with how the torpedo lands, but you don't have a problem with the device that can create life in 7 minutes?
well, that is... That comes from Shatner's brilliant DNA coursing through her veins. Of course... Of course she's going to figure out godlike space technologies. the danger with the Genesis thing, Khan was going to blow up the Genesis machine and force the planet to get real planty all of a sudden? Is that
No, if he had this technology, he could go to any planet and wipe it out with his doomsday device.
How would it wipe it out? Wouldn't it just say awesome plants?
No, it would just, it would take whatever life was there and blow it up and then turn it into whatever the Genesis device is programmed to turn it into.
Okay.
So there are people there, they all die.
Okay.
Right.
So break
Universal
it down.
Armageddon is
ideally, use it on a lifeless moon or space body.
Exactly.
So, right. So,
and you may not remember from the end, after the Enterprise totally disables the Reliant, they're about to board and stuff. Khan is still alive, heavily injured, but he sets the Genesis device to go off in the middle of the nebula as his last chance to blow up them, because he knows the Enterprise is too close to get away, which leads into Spock having to sacrifice himself to help them escape.
Right. Okay.
Does Kirk face the no-win scenario, or is this Spock's no-win scenario?
I'd say this is definitely Spock's no-win scenario.
Spock's the one who makes...
Yeah.
It is a version of a no-win scenario for Kirk, but it's because of a sacrifice by one of his crew members that allows him to win, because otherwise he's dead.
And his best friend?
Yes.
Was
and has always been his best friend.
I had a little problem with this friendship, this quote-unquote friendship that they're talking about. I feel like they're really hitting what good friends they are in this movie, and then at the end it's like, oh, you are my best friend. And I was kind of like, Kirk doesn't treat Spock like a very good friend throughout most of the interactions I've seen with them. And I feel like they're just saying it, so we're supposed to be like, oh, yeah, they're great friends. They said they're friends.
And I also feel like with Spock, you have the whole, being a Vulcan, being a being of intellect, recognizing that, and it's not that Vulcans have no emotions. It's that they go through these grueling things and training through their youth in order to maintain control over them.
Supremacy over their emotions.
And so I feel like Spock, even through the series, I think it's completely viable that Spock just looked at Kirk and is like, yeah, you're just kind of a prick. That's just what you are. And so that
Like you anyway.
Well, just that very logical side of him accepted. And there were still compassionate moments.
But there were times where Kirk went out. What was the one where Spock, in the episode where Spock had that whole thing, he was like...
The Ponfar.
The Ponfar episode.
Yeah.
He
killed Kirk, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and there were still plenty of times that Kirk did kind of sort of put his neck on the line for
Spock.
And for other crewmen.
I was thinking
about...
And it occurred to me that the city, because the one thing that always bothered me now that I'm thinking about it, it probably should bother me, was the fact that you've never faced the no-win scenario. I've never faced death like this, but on the city, sitting on the edge of forever, he really falls in love with Joan Collins very deeply. And when they have to let her die in order for history to go on the correct path, I believe he's so despondent that doesn't Spock actually wipe the memory from his brain at that point?
Does he? I don't know.
I thought at the end of that episode...
I mean,
I go home and watch
I remember there being the discussion...
So.
I remember there being the discussion in the whole thing do you realize what you're doing? And them having to be like, yeah, we do, actually.
How many people on the planet Earth are currently trying to look up how despondent Kirk was in that one episode? I don't think so, because I think when they get back, like, he's
Kirk
really
crying.
Depressed when he
despondent.com.
Beams back up to the Enterprise.
He does, but after they're like in sickbay or he's in his quarters, and I'm pretty sure that Spock wipes
years.
His memory of the experience.
Watch Kirk cry on it.
Wait for single hair.
Oh, turns out it's Kirk Cameron. Damn it!
Too much.
Keep talking, Lily.
But yeah, I feel like, and they've had all that time together, and they've had all those years of development, and there was the fact that, you know, Spock went off and, you know, joined Starfleet when it wasn't necessarily what his family wanted
for
him. And so he had, you know, more of that bond with Kirk because Enterprise, in a lot of ways, became his family. It became his foundation.
Yeah.
Because his family really had been like, you're gonna go join Starfleet? Meh! And it took them a while to come back to accepting him for it.
Yeah. Well, and even, was it the first movie, Spock was just kind of super logical.
He's just like purged his emotions, and like, they even make it a plot point of like, McCoy saying to Kirk, can we trust him? Like, he's in contact with this V'ger, maybe he's working for it, you know? Huh. Like, there's this distrust, which I don't actually really like. Like, I get why it's there, but it's,
yeah, you think Bones would be over it by then.
No, Bones is pretty racist towards Spock.
Yeah.
Forever.
Continuously.
At the beginning of the second movie, it's Kirk's birthday, which I love.
Yep.
And, I mean, Spock's gotten him a gift, a Tale of Two Cities. Mm-hmm. So.
Message Spock.
Yes.
Message Spock.
The best of times, it was the worst of times.
Did you find the answer to that?
Tell me something?
Do you know?
It doesn't say in the wiki plot summary. So, if it wasn't that episode, he did it at some other point.
So,
I'm pretty sure it was that one. But I also believe, like, in terms of the relationship, I believe in the episode where they introduce Mark Leonard as Sarek, that Kirk is defending Spock to his own father at some point. It does come up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Who totally dislikes the fact that Spock left Vulcan and became part of the Federation Starfleet.
Yeah.
So yeah, they have a deep history for him.
That's fair. I'll relent.
Well, it's surely if you come to the movie cold, you're like, what? What is this? It doesn't have any meaning. You need that context for that sacrifice to really hit.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I always knew that they were friends. I was like, oh yeah, Spock and Kirk and McCoy.
But did you see them be friends to each other, or was it just like,
no, they were
you
friends
accept
on the show.
They were friends on the show.
Right, but I mean, if you had come into this movie, Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, I think in the beginning, the birthday presents, the camaraderie, if you're coming in new to it, it sets the tone that, they go back a long way. And that's the reason why you say they kind of beat you over the head with the, you know, we've been best friends. That was for new people they're pulling in that, you know, hadn't watched the original series.
And then, Pat, I think you're the one who mentioned this, but Spock even says to him, like, you should be a captain. Being an admiral was a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, that scene in Spock's quarters.
Can you
quarters,
turn down an admiralship? Can you turn that down?
Probably.
I think so.
Yeah, you can always turn out a promotion.
If you
want to get into Starfleet law, why Kirk even has a job after the end of Star Trek 2 is completely ridiculous. Anybody else would have been drummed out of the service for getting his entire crew killed for not following regulations.
I don't know, I'm not even going to lie. I think there was a lot of things even before that that would have gotten him drummed out.
The events of the third one, I mean.
But
he did save the planet in 4, so everything got wiped clean.
So he just got demoted. That's all.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things in the setup of 2 that, like, I've never really been on board with as far as, like, just the logistics of them, where I'm like, no, wait, how can they, but what,
it's sci-fi, it's just made up.
Do you not like that Kirk is admiral, or?
No, I'm fine with Kirk being an admiral, but there's just a lot of things, so many things for the setup for Wrath of Khan that I was just like, wait a minute, first of all, so Reliant's going to go out and be like, yeah, we're going to specifically scope out this area to see if this horrible, you know, barren planet will be a good place to test the Genesis device. In this whole thing of SETI Alpha 1 through 6.
And the one planet exploding?
Right. So even like you're in the area, an entire planet is gone. And you're not going to be like, wait a minute, guys, we might want to look at... So they land on the wrong planet to start investigating this. And then, you know, there's Khan and he sees Chekhov. He's like, I remember you.
No, you don't.
Chekhov's
not in
there. He wasn't there.
He's not
That's
in
awesome.
He was below decks.
And
didn't I see your headshot in the lobby of the Enterprise?
But then it's also like, okay. okay, Captain of the Reliant at that point is like, who's this? What's going on? Now here's, like, I can very easily see, yeah, you aren't going to read every single report that every starship captain turns in ever. However, you're going to this area and be like, we're going to be checking out all these planets in this area where this previous captain, like, chopped off a whole bunch of people 15 years ago. Really, you aren't going to be like, wait a minute, like, that's not ever going
to
come
up.
I think
Kirk forgot to file that.
which is why he's a little embarrassed about his entire ship
getting taken over.
Right. I mean, so that whole thing, I'm like, okay, so if Kirk didn't file it, if he's like, okay, so instead of, like, bringing these people up on charges and whatever else, which is part of Space City, he's like, okay, instead of making you go back and face court martials and all this other crap, I'm going to give you this planet. Bye. So say he doesn't say anything about it. He never files any reports whatsoever. Once again, Chekhov, how do you know?
Yeah.
You were there.
My argument is that he was on the ship at that time. You just didn't see it.
There was an interview with Walter Koenig, and he knew he was not in that episode, but he didn't want to say anything because he wanted to work on the film. So he was like, oh, yeah, I mean,
they tried to fix it later in, like, books and things like that. But still, I'm like, I'm looking at the whole thing and I'm like, so there's a lot there to lead you to believe that Kirk just went in. He's like, no, we aren't. Just don't put that in your reports, anybody. Just don't bring that up.
It didn't bother me because the universe is a massive place. Yeah. And Starfleet itself is a massive multi-planetary organization. So for them to not be aware, it never once bothered me.
I don't know, but I feel like if you're going specifically to that area,
for me, it's a relatively minor plot hole in an otherwise very good movie.
I think it's a wonderful movie. I do love it. But that is one of those things that I'm just like, wait a minute. Because again, how do you go to this, you know, solar system and not catch on to the fact there's an entire planet missing?
Yeah. I feel they've got.
How do you not notice that?
It's because it shifted the orbit of the other planet, so all of a sudden, magically, they
But you can
up.
Still
so
count.
They kind of look.
But you can still count from
1 to 5.
Number 9
must have drifted off somewhere. Just keep going.
I feel they've gotten better.
Their computers, like, weren't as good in 1982.
especially like in the universe of Next Generation, the Federation has gotten really good about
using science
and categorizing things. But I mean, it's like, oh, we need to look up this very specific piece of information. Thankfully, the Enterprise database has all knowledge, and all star charts. But I've always gotten from the impression of the original series that it's more of a, in the original six movies, that it's a rougher time. It's like, you know.
Right, tag fleet.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely the cowboy mentality. That's how people like Kirk were able to, you know, succeed so well. And...
Well, what I liked about it, because taking the plot holes as a given, you know, having Chekhov on that other ship with the new captain allows Khan to deliver that exposition in a very natural, organic way, which you had to get out somewhere, and just the way he does it, and it's just wonderful. It's right up there.
When he's like, I've never met Admiral Kirk, and he's just like, Admiral. He just hears the words.
God,
he's like,
eyes.
He's a fucking admiral. He left me here.
He promoted him for getting rid of me.
Yes.
Oh, I love it. Oh, Ricardo Montalban. Hey, Mark.
Hey.
how you doing, my outcast?
I'm doing good, my incast.
What are you thinking over there, buddy?
I was just having a tangent thought about plot holes in general. Mm-hmm. Like, I love The Dark Knight, but there's a lot of problems with that movie.
Like Act 4?
Yeah. And I think that, in this, I was kind of thinking this when we started the podcast, like, with nerdy stuff, people who like it have a special reverence for it, and I include myself in that. And so, like, you acknowledge that there are problems, but it's still okay. It's like a marriage. It's like, yeah, my spouse snores.
You're past
Sorry.
The flaws for the beauty.
I'm new to this. Don't ruin it for me already.
And you're like, but the whole thing is worthwhile. So I will say, you know, I love it, even though it's plot snores or whatever.
Well, I mean, and I think for anything like this, I mean, movies, plays, whatever, I mean, we have to accept, like, there has to be a certain suspension of disbelief. So there has to be
space
certain...
travel.
Pshaw. I mean, there has to be certain things where you're gonna be like, okay, I'm not gonna look at it. I'm just not gonna look at it. or you're gonna find ways to rationalize it right. for yourself. But
I used to
but work... a whole planet.
I used to work with a guy who was in the like cosplay stormtrooper group.
Oh, was he
like...
in the 501st?
Yes, he was in the 501st, and he said to me that he thinks of Star Wars as like a religion, and he's like. You know, you go through and there's the different chapters, the different books, and the different, like, apocrypha, and there's stuff in there that you really disagree with, and you really wish it wasn't written down, but it's part of it, and you still choose to enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, even though there's stuff like, you must not eat cheese on Wednesdays,
thus,
or whatever.
Thus the faction of Jar Jar was formed.
Oh.
So it's like, yeah, he's like, I hate Jar Jar Binks, but I still love Star Wars.
You can't, two Gungans can't marry, like, I mean, that's... We're at the hour mark. So I'm going to go in and kind of open it up. Is there anything we haven't touched on that you guys would like to touch on? There is actually one thing we haven't talked about that I do want to talk about. No, there's two things. Never mind.
Let's talk about them.
Okay. This score is by James Horner, and this actually might be my favorite movie score. I think this is... And then I think Jerry Goldsmith's theme from the motion picture is brilliant. I love it. I mean, they use it half a dozen gazillion times throughout the rest of the show and universe. But something about James Horner's score I really like. The main melody, I'm going to play it now through the magic of, you know.
That was beautiful. You're right, Chris.
God,
you really sold
like
us.
That.
Thank God you didn't take time to edit that in later.
Yeah, no.
Well, what's interesting with the score, though, is that James Horner, he obviously works a lot, or he, certainly at that
he
time.
Does.
And so if you see Aliens, if you see Willow, if you see these other things, you hear these common elements that he keeps coming back, the clanging metal, the trumpet flourish. I mean, it's like when I saw Aliens, like, oh, man, I remember that from Wrath of Khan.
Well, there's a very specific reason that happened.
Oh, please fill in.
You not heard this?
No.
Supposedly, James Horner had huge fights with James Cameron.
Why?
And he was,
you believe that?
I don't know why. Why would you have a fight with James Cameron? And he was also brought into the project very late and given a very harsh deadline, so he was kind of like, well, screw it. I'm going to rip myself off, which he did. There were blatant... cards of Star Trek II's score in Aliens.
Weird.
I do think this is one of those things that, like, just for the fact that, like, even as, like, sleek and shiny and smooth as our space travel and space battles are, there's still a lot of points, especially with the remnants of the Botany Bay and everything else, that is still very gritty and, like, heavy technology and clunky tech. Which is why I think a lot of those specific elements of the metal clanging and stuff like that just really feeds the feeling of the film for that.
Just a quick side question. Was it really important on your spacesuit to have a handle right in front?
It's hard on Montablanc.
So your space belt could just pick you up.
You can put it on your space hanger easier. Right.
I bet they wish they had more of those in Gravity, though.
That would help.
Oh, thank God.
It would have solved so many problems for Sandra Bullock.
Now, does Khan lose an eye in towards the end when he's getting
bleeding,
space roughed up?
Yeah, I think it might have gone white from regret, but it's half of his face is seriously.
Yeah. I feel like as soon as a villain loses an eye in a movie, you know they're gonna die. Because it's like, you're scary to look at now. No offense to anybody who's lost an eye. But
when Khan shows up, I mean, it's pretty obvious that Ricardo Montalban does not want to survive. Like, he's gonna either, like, kill everyone or die
because
trying.
He's Ahab.
Because he's Ahab.
Because he stabs at you from the darkness. So.
Yeah. I mean, he's an angry man. Conveniently, he gets a super weapon.
Yes.
You know?
A super weapon.
It was originally called the Omega Device.
Ooh.
But they thought that was too, like, that's a name the Federation would not give it.
Right.
You know?
Well, I think it's much better as the Genesis device anyway. Yeah. It just gives you the ambiguity, and that, I mean, that sets up the whole conversation between Kirk and Spock, Kirk, Spock and McCoy, midway through,
that?
About the moral implications of, the, of this whole technology, which is great.
And you wouldn't think of a thing called the Genesis device as being something that's going to destroy a world.
You know, Phil Collins kind of makes
One other thing about this film, I love how they portray space combat. I mean, it is a direct opposition to, well, actually it's not direct opposition because they do this in Star Wars also. But large capital ships do not move like fighters. They move like large ships.
Yes.
And
It's slow. Shocking.
It's two submarines, essentially. It reminded me of the Balance of Terror episode.
Yeah.
As far as the way they played their combat out.
Yeah, I guess that was probably one of the single biggest differences in the J.J. Abrams track is just how they do the space combat. Which, there's stuff about it. I like the fact they can actually, you know, play it in Z. But I think it's better than like the space combat in the Next Gen when they did that a few times with the Borg. I mean, that never looked well.
Yeah,
never. I mean,
and the uniforms. The uniforms are great.
Yeah, much better than the motion picture.
The white span, whatever that was that they were in.
Wait, did they have like in this one? Did they have like the red shirts with the?
The weird like turtleneck things and then the epaulets.
It's like a fake ruff.
Yes.
Of a turtleneck.
Yes, but you got to have that beautiful moment when when the one ensign is dying and Kirk has like unbuttoned the front and folded that corner down so he has that white square.
Yeah.
So you then get like the bloody handprint, which he then leaves open and there for the rest. You're like,
until he changes uniforms, go down to the
Well, the uniform
station.
Change that was Nick Meyer wanting a more nautical.
He saw
Kirk as Horatio Hornblower, and he really wanted this whole nautical thing going, which is why. It's shifted. It's one of the most definitive uniforms for Trek.
Speaking of that, I totally forgot to mention this, but Gene Roddenberry was blamed heavily for the failure of the first film. Not that the first film didn't make money. It did make money, but it cost a ridiculous amount, like $492 million, I think, at the time, which was ridiculous.
I mean, not 492, because even Avatar is like 200, maybe 49 million.
Okay, maybe it was 49 million. Yeah. The first film was a lot. So Gene Roddenberry was moved to an executive consultant role. He had no control over the script. He disliked Khan, and he did not like the naval texture of like the ships or the uniforms or anything. He disliked all that, but he had no power over it.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're your own worst enemy. I mean, with Next Gen, the lack of, he really wanted that lack of conflict among the crew, and in doing so, really made it antiseptic. I mean,
it took a couple seasons
for them to get anything going.
Oh, Gene Roddenberry. You have such high hopes. Come on, man.
Get it together.
Couple of final questions here that I'll ask after. But is there anything that you guys want to talk about that we haven't touched on?
One of the things that I so love about this is that Kirk and Khan are never in the same place.
That's weird.
But I love that because again, it is the Moby Dick story. Yeah. It is Ahab on this demented, obsessive hunt, and then having these like nautical battles through things. But it's a brilliant thing to see that Khan is still able to be so powerful and so manipulative. And so controlling that, like, he can have Kirk screaming into space for this and not have to touch him.
Yeah.
And I think it was so beautiful that, you know, come to the end of it when Kirk's like, no, if you want to kill me, you're going to have to come here. You're going to have to come here and do this. And Khan's like, nah, I don't have to. I've broken you. I have killed things that you love. And that, to me, is just brilliant. And I feel like, if you're going to have a villain, like if you're gonna have somebody who's like really someone who you can really love to hate, I just think it's nice that you have somebody who is intelligent and charismatic, and despite all of his insanity and his obsessive hunt, have that moment towards the end of it when he's like, no, I'm gonna let you live and suffer. That is just brilliantly sadistic.
Yeah, it's great writing. I think it's a testament to that's a great point. It's a testament to both Ricardo Montalban and Bill Shatner as actors, because in the interview with Ricardo Montalban, he's talking about how he's delivering these great soliloquies, and he's reading to the script girl. And
because it was done like months.
Superior intellect.
It was done months apart.
Yeah,
And that I also think, I mean, and I also think that's a credit to some wonderful directing to be able to get that from your actors and still be able to like pair that to balance that and make it work. But
George
again,
Lucas can do the
months
same thing.
Apart. Because he'll just animate somebody and throw them in there.
I'm so glad
they
did.
In front of a green screen, I'm going to give you no direction, go.
Yeah.
Take a Muppet, run!
I'm glad they never met. I'm so glad they didn't, like, try and shoehorn a fist fight in there or anything.
Yeah.
Which they would have, like, that's part of the original series.
And
I'm so glad they didn't do that.
And I think that really, again, really serves the whole, like, the fact that Kirk in the beginning, you know, he is, like, his whole character through this movie is old. And slow and losing it. And I think if you had physically put him up against Khan, who's spent now 15 years on this planet physically fighting for his survival and who is still super chiseled. I mean, holy crap!
You know, not to go uber deep on this, but this is something that just occurred to me. I can't imagine they thought of this when they were doing it. But the fact that he never interacts with Kirk, it's still the ghosts of his past chasing him. It's still, you know, it's because of if they'd been face-to-face, it wouldn't have been the same thing. It's just this thing out there from his past.
It's
going to get him.
It's that
can't actually get to him.
Haunting. It's like, here are the
haunted
repercussions of your actions, of all these things that you've done, and you can't actually touch it. You can't fix what is past. You just have to try to figure out how to move forward. And that, I think, is so much of the story arc and so much of Kirk's story arc in this. Yeah. It's like, Kobayashi Maru, you beat it before because you cheated. You rewrote it. And so now it's finally putting him into a position of being like, here's things that you can't cheat. Here's stuff that has just happened. So now what are you going to do? And he has to grow from that. He has to evolve from that.
Does anybody know if there is like a character test for military training? Like, do they do some type of
a psychological evaluation?
Psychological,
assume so.
Yeah.
One would hope.
Nah. Not at all.
I mean, for standard military, I mean, there is a psych evaluation. It's the same sort of format test that they have for police officers.
I think it's just the results get stuck. The guy that was it, the guy that shot up the military base. I mean, like, they had their reports on him for years that happened.
I mean, because they have some people that they're just like,
trouble.
Be like, hey, you know, these things could very realistically lead to violent and life-threatening situations, and for whatever reason, you don't need to be in those situations. You know, because there's some people who just, much like Ender's Game, you know, you're too fragile and you can't deal with it, or you're just too violent and you can't deal with it.
We have an Ender's Game podcast. You should go listen to it. Mr. Outcast, do you have any questions or comments or observations?
I'm going to make some more snarky comments.
Do it. You're allowed to. You're the Outcast.
Thank you. So, like, in much the same way that, like, I can like the old James Bond movies, but they can be terribly dated, like, just the aesthetics of this movie, like Shatner's perm and Khan's white mullet are just like glaring
pieces of amazing.
I don't believe Khan's is in fact a mullet. He has bangs. But it's not a mullet.
It's not a mullet?
No.
Okay.
It's just long and flowing.
like the lion of the pride.
Yes.
They just kind of stick out to me as indicators of their time. Mm-hmm. I don't know if movies nowadays that like are sci-fi movies are trying to be more timeless.
We won't know for 20 years.
Right. Like, maybe we'll look back and be like, oh, that was so 90s or whatever.
Yeah, the grammar of film has certainly changed. I mean, everything's much faster paced now. The camera's constantly moving. You would never see a film like that made today that doesn't just move constantly.
That's true.
Do the 70s trappings of Star Wars bother you? Like Luke's hair and Han's hair and...
Yes.
No, because that's how things are in space, especially backwards planets like Tatooine.
You mean a long time ago? long time ago.
No, that's how they are
exactly
now.
I think it buys you a lot. I mean, it is kind of timeless because they're not trying to recreate our future. And in Star Trek, our future has moved well past them. The whole idea of a prefix code that could shut down a starship. I mean, you're familiar with 64-bit web keys and all kinds of stuff you put on it. It's like, it would never be that easy. You couldn't do it in 2 seconds. I mean, but we didn't know that back then because the whole notion of networking, internet security, nobody knew any of that. So, there's definitely elements that just won't hold.
That's fair.
But, I mean, I think they did a lot with Captain Janeway to try to give her the exact same hair that Mr. Savick had. So, I mean, I think that's still...
Oh, poor Kate.
I think that still carries.
Like, for the Star Wars fashion, I think that Star Wars does a much better job than the Trek films I've seen of being like creating a aesthetic. Like, even though Luke and Harrison Ford have kind of 70s hair, like with Princess Leia, they're always trying to do something weird that like women don't wear, even in the 70s, mm-hmm. you know, and the costumes are more like medieval in space. So I think they're removed enough from that era that it's like, oh, this is how people dress in Star Wars.
But I also think you have a little bit of a differentiation in the idea that, with, you know, with Star Trek, you're still dealing predominantly with Earthlings.
Yeah, in our future.
Also military in our future.
Yeah.
Which is basically what the Federation is. It's simply a military.
Yeah.
So it's all straight uniforms where, you know, you look at Star Wars and the Empire's all wearing the same uniform.
But if they're military, why does Shatner have a man perm?
Because he's an admiral
for a really great
When
you're an admiral, you can get a perm.
Alright.
But he should
just
be a
captain. Just something to keep in mind, Mark. For when you want to get your perm.
So will my hair grow back if I become an admiral
yes.
and I get upgraded to that perm?
Yes, that is how that works.
Sweet.
Well, if anyone does have anything specific they want to talk about, I've got a few questions that I want to ask each of my experts. Mark, I'm not going to ask you because I am going to ask you. I will ask you these questions.
All right.
Kitten, I'll start with you. Is this your favorite Trek movie?
Yeah, I think it is because I think it is the one that overall has the best story.
You said you think it is. Is there one? Is there another one that you're also
The first one I just think is the first movie. I still think is just wonderful and like one of my very first girl crushes with Ilea, and I'm like, hooray there because Paul chicks are hot. I don't know. I mean, I think the first movie has more of a spectacle and whatnot, I still think 2 is a much better story. My only hesitancy to saying like it's my favorite one is, you know, going back and rewatching it, which I've done a few times, is that it is very slow paced. You know, especially compared to contemporary cinema. It's, you know, it is very much a long, trudging story. There's not a huge sense of urgency in getting anything done. But overall, I still think it is the most solid, well-founded, and in-depth story told by any of the Star Trek movies or series.
Okay. Favorite moment in this film?
My favorite moment in this film was the isolated shot of Khan on the deck of the Reliant quoting Moby Dick as he's like getting ready to go and hunt down Kirk and the Enterprise. Because now like he's made it through the docks, he's, you know, found his ship, he's, you know, and now he's getting ready to go on his hunt. And I love that because it was beautiful and poetic, and I love the use of the classic literature because, again, I feel very much that this is the Moby Dick story. It's very much just exactly that story. And it doesn't
even From the perspective of the whale.
Well, it's like, it doesn't even try to hide it.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that for it. And I love the fact that it's still like, here's Khan, who is potentially this horrible, despotic killing machine, but he's still very intelligent and has this appreciation for art and literature. And that the fact that he embraces that this is his madness, and he's still going to go and do this. So he's very self-aware in that moment and still pursues this.
Well, it's just because Kirk taxes him.
He does. And, you know, but also, like, it's very much that foreshadowing that, you know, Moby Dick killed Ahab and everybody else. And
what?
Spoiler.
Books!
I haven't watched that movie yet.
Books!
Damn you, Herman Melville!
Pat.
Yes.
Pat.
Yes.
Is this your favorite Trek movie?
Yes, without a doubt.
Okay. What's your favorite moment?
You know, I was thinking about it while you were talking to Kitten, and I was going to say Spock's death, but I realized it's just before that. It's when Kirk is on the bridge, and he radios down, good job, Scotty.
Oh, yeah, and he realizes.
And Bones gets on there, Kirk, Jim, you better get down here. And he looks over and sees Spock's seat empty because he had not realized Spock had left the bridge. Mm-hmm. And that's a beautiful moment. That, of course, leads
his run down there. Yeah. It's like the planet is forming and the music and Spock's down. Yeah, it's not good. It's not good. Mark.
Yo.
Is this your favorite Trek movie?
It's not my favorite Trek movie. Sorry. Bless you.
All right. What is your favorite Trek
movie? Either Generations or... This is excluding the new ones.
You can... Oh, you can include
like,
that.
This is excluding the new ones because I've only seen the first new one once and I haven't seen the second new one yet.
Khan's in that one too.
Yeah. But he's the guy. He's Sherlock and I like that Sherlock.
Benedict Cumberbatch is great.
He rocks, but...
Not as Khan.
Not the right Khan.
Generations or First Contact. Probably First Generations, Contact. Even though I do like the Borg and space zombie scenarios.
Ironically, First Contact is also a Captain Ahab.
Yeah. Because the Borg is Patrick Stewart's wife.
And again,
he also played Captain Ahab in the British production.
And again, for that one, sexy bald women.
Sexy bald women. Who's the sexy bald woman?
Oh, it's the Queen of the Borg.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
So sexy.
Alice Cruz.
Oh, yes.
It's hard to be super sexy when you're just like the top of a torso and rotting flesh and no hair.
But she is.
Yeah.
Especially with the spine that's just slightly prehensile as it goes to.
All right.
Dude.
And she blows on Data's new skin. Right? And he's like, oh, this is the best.
This is going in a weird direction.
This is when Star Trek got his
balls. I must be old fashioned when I find sexy.
Okay, well, that'll be a whole other podcast just that.
Sex in space.
Dominic, is this your favorite Trek movie?
Of the original series cast, yeah. Like 2 and 4, 6, I love them all, but 4 and 6 aren't quite as executed as well as this one from a story standpoint, although there's some really wonderful moments in all of it. So,
what's your favorite moment in...
It's hard to pick a single one. I think it's the character beats. It's the beat we talked about earlier with McCoy and Kirk and his condo or apartment, whatever the hell it was. The scene with the two of them. And then in the end, because I just remember, you know, I think it's probably the first time I cried at a movie was at the end of it. Just because it really hits. And like for a long time, it was very difficult to watch that scene without getting choked up because I'd really come to identify with those characters. Mm-hmm. So...
Yeah, and I mean, I have to go back to something Kitten said. You said you found it plotting, or I don't at all. I find this... The pacing was beautiful. I mean, I'll rewind to watch those moments, those slow conversations because it's just great stuff. And that's great movie making. There's no car chases and explosions that need to break up every five minutes of the movie.
And I love that. I think it's a brilliant character film. Yeah. It's a beautiful story.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful narrative.
I wonder how different it would have been had Kirk been the one who, if they flipped it and Kirk had been the one who died. Of course, it'd be very hard to bring him back.
And if you bring him back, it would be totally like a Jesus thing because he's like, "I'm so great,
I can't die.
I walk among you."
Look at that.
We're
going into the neutral zone. I'm taking.
I mean, people really like Kirk, but people love Spock. Yeah. And
do you think they like Spock more than Kirk?
I think so because he's so different. He was very unique at the time.
It's easier for a stereotypical nerd to identify with Spock rather than Kirk,
because
Kirk gets the girls. He's charming. Spock is, like, smart. He studies. And people are like, yeah, you can come to the party, but whatever.
Since you're with these pledges on this
guy. Right?
I think I know who you identify with.
Totally. I think I mentioned this in the classic.
Yeah, you did.
But I think there's a sense that because of Spock's lack of emotion that he would not be unmoored in the same way by Kirk's death as Kirk would be unmoored by Spock's death.
Yeah.
Although I still think it was one of those moments, like even in Spock's death, you got to see that beautiful moment of his break of emotion, of being like, yeah, I chose to do this because I love you guys. You know, because it's what you do. I mean, but still it was like, you know, you knew it hurt him to do this, like to know that he had to do this.
Well,
and it was a beautiful moment.
Well,
heart-wrenching.
That's on that heart-wrenching moment. I think we will end this podcast. Does anybody have anything they wish to plug? Other podcasts or things that you're working on? I see you shaking your head over there, Mr. Outcast.
Hi.
What do you want to talk about?
If this is your listener's first time hearing a Mark Soloff episode, then they'll be treated to the same old plug. I do my own podcast, which is a comedy show It's a fake science show called Blastro Podcast. You can find it on iTunes and Stitcher or on blastropodcast.com. One of these days, I'm going to get old Chris Bashan to be a guest. We'll see what we can't work out.
I would love to be a guest.
A guest?
A guest. That'd be great.
Are you going to be a guest?
I'll be a guest. I'll be the guest. Guest.
You're the gassiest guest I know.
All right.
This is all right.
Anybody else have anything they wish to plug?
Yeah, and if this is your first time listening to a Kitten McCreary plug on this podcast, you can hear me as the co-host on DiscreetFX.com, talking about wonderful, sciencey, nerdy things. We just did a wonderful podcast on portable video editing equipment.
Ooh. if you are in the Chicago area in December, I will be doing a Christmas show at the Public House Theater. I have no clue where all my listeners are, so maybe they're in the area. I can also tease another podcast, but I can't really say anything other than that there's another podcast in the works.
In the Bashan Empire?
Not in my empire, but in an empire of friends.
Plug on it.
Yeah, I know. If you have any comments, questions, protests, or topic suggestions, please email them to nerdoutcastpodcast@gmail.com. I have been your host, Chris Bashan, and tonight, talking with me about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, have been...
Kitten McCreary.
Patrick Sweetman.
Mark Soloff.
Dominic Ciancio.
Thank you, thank you for listening.
I laugh at your superior intellect, Chris.
I stab at thee.